This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Life on the front line. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Emergency room nurses are striking a delicate balance these days, caring for pandemic patients while trying to avoid bringing the virus home.
Under the same roof, the new complications for divorced parents during stay-at-home restrictions.
How tattoo shops and frontline medical professionals have found common ground during the COVID-19 outbreak.
And the new trend among younger TV watchers, closed captioning.
These are people who don't need it. Who hear just fine, but really sort of prefer to have that kind of text crawl across their screen because it just kind of enhances the viewing experience for them and the understanding of what's happening on screen.
John Jurgensen at the Wall Street Journal on why closed captioning has become trendy among non-traditional users. Imagine going to work every day knowing that you are going to come into some kind of contact with a patient diagnosed with the new coronavirus, and then you went home after your shift and faced the challenge of trying not to infect your family. Such is life for nurses and doctors on the front lines. Liz Babbitt is an emergency room nurse in New York City. Liz, is it more stressful now?
I think a lot of people that work in the emergency department and probably throughout the hospital, to some degree, it's the same as every day when you punch in, especially in the emergency department as you're walking in. You have no idea on a normal day if you're going to have a great day with some pretty quiet patients and, you know, some abdominal pains, or if you're going to have strokes after heart attacks and it's going to be a crazy 12 and a half hours. So to some degree, we're used to walking in and not really knowing how our shift is going to go. But right now, we've in some ways actually have a better idea because we kind of know what's facing us. We know that there are going to be a lot of really sick people coming in that are going to require a lot of our resources and, you know, a lot of staff working together to make sure that we can handle this together.
You guys must all have some look or eye contact that you trade once in a while, like, well, when is this going to end? Or, you know, hang in there, my friend, something along those lines. Like, you know, there's a certain camaraderie that's been elevated in this time.
I would say that ER doctors, nurses, you know, techs, the people that answer the phones, we all have always had to have that camaraderie.
Okay.
Actually, my first year in the emergency department was during Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, it was kind of the same idea where you just show up and you know that the only way you're going to get through it is with everyone together. So, sure, there's a sense of the only people that really know what you're going through are the people that are with you during those 12 and a half hours, as well as, you know, if you know somebody working in Boston in one of those ERs. You kind of have, you could give them the same exact look that you could give the person that was just in the room with you next to, you know, a coronavirus patient. So absolutely, there's a very deep sense of working with each other and making sure that we look out for each other, making sure that people can get on, you know, go and eat lunch. You see that your coworker hasn't been able to step away and have something to drink or eat something really quickly, and making sure that we do that for each other.
Yeah. How do you protect yourself?
We're just following exactly what hospital administration and, you know, what all the regulatory agencies are having us do. We are, you know, using all of the masks that we're supposed to use. I am lucky enough to work in a hospital system where we have, at least for now, we have appropriate protective gear. We've certainly had to make some modifications as to, you know, maybe the face masks that we used to use aren't the same face masks that we use now, but we have been, you know, given what we need during a shift, at least for now. Mm-hmm. And again, just doing what everybody's supposed to do, wash your hands, don't touch your face, you know, be aware of, you know, trying to maintain some distance between people.
Yeah. We're speaking with Liz Babiff. She's an ER nurse in New York on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic. You have three young kids at home. So what's it like when your shift is over and you head back into your own home? Then what do you do?
Well, being in New York, my home is a very small two-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment. So, you know, the idea of being able to socially distance from my family or kind of try to keep them away is a little tougher than if we had a house where I could go and get changed in the garage or, you know, have a specific bathroom for mom mm-hmm. for right now or something like that. But I'm trying to maintain as much normalcy for them as possible and, you know, coming home, making sure that my scrubs, you know, go straight into the laundry, shower, all of that stuff before hugs and kisses and good nights and everything. And then during the week, it's basically, unlike a lot of the other parents, at home trying to teach their kids subtraction, things that I never thought I'd be doing in the meantime.
And so back to the hospital for just a moment. I think you referenced it, but you guys have had no equipment availability problems, just some stuff might be different?
For now, we've been really lucky. Everything through what they are saying we need, from what they are saying as far as how we are supposed to use our masks, from, you know, which masks we're supposed to use during which procedures, we have not had to worry about running out of those supplies. They have certainly changed, you know, we're used to using some of the surgical masks once, and now we are, you know, supposed to use them throughout the day. So there have been some of those changes.
Okay.
But we have not had to worry about actual supply running out, at least as of right now.
Oh, thanks, Liz. Liz Babiff, emergency room nurse in New York City. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
You're a small business owner, and there's nothing small about what you do. That's why Dell Small Business Technology Advisors give you trusted advice, one-on-one partnership, and tailored tech solutions, like computers with Intel Core processors, servers, storage, networking, plus thousands of top-brand electronics, accessories, and software. No matter your technology needs, Dell is here to help your small business do big things. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. The coronavirus pandemic is causing stress and tumult in families around the world. Things can get even more complicated when parents are divorced or separated. Some former spouses disagree about what social distancing and stay-at-home directives mean. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Times okay. are tough enough these days, but if you're divorced and trying to manage children, it's even more complicated. Andrea Peterson of the Wall Street Journal has written about some families who are struggling with the rules and joins us now. Andrea, who did you talk to?
I talked to several couples, former couples, actually, people who are divorced or separated with children. And, you know, families of all kinds are finding it tough to navigate stay-at-home orders and social distancing, but it gets even more complicated in families where the parents are divorced or separated, where there's two homes, and you know, oftentimes, you know, parents who may not agree on a lot of things are not necessarily agreeing on what exactly a stay-at-home order means. Does that mean no play dates? Does that mean yes or some play dates? You know, also issues of, you know, where to shelter in place. You know, some actually, I've talked to divorce lawyers and mediators who are saying that they've had a couple clients who have decided to, you know, former spouses who've decided to move back in together and all quarantine together, which, you know, can raise its own issues. And then other people are deciding, you know, it's safer for the kids to sort of remain in one home for the duration. But, you know, things also get a lot more complicated when you have blended families and new partners who may have children of their own and also ex-spouses. So as one woman told me, the idea of creating a circle around her and her children and her ex was really difficult because, there's a lot of other people sort of in the mix. The ex had a girlfriend who also had children and an ex-husband and elderly parents who had caregivers going from their home. So things can get quite complicated.
Andrea, are the couples trying to work these problems out themselves, or do they have someone they can turn to help?
Well, that's the issue, that parents are largely being left to hammer these out, these sort of differences out themselves without the help of the judicial system. Across the country, many family courts are closed, or they're only considering emergency cases, such as those involving domestic violence or the need for restraining orders. So, though I talked to the head of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and she told me that, most jurisdictions require that existing custody arrangements remain in place even when schools are closed. So that's sort of but sometimes that's just not practical or maybe not safe. The issue that she was seeing is that, the biggest sort of differences people are having is fights over time with the children. Some parents wanting more or even all of the time because they're concerned about potential exposure to the virus in the other parent's home, or others want less time. There's some in some families where, maybe one parent only has every other weekend, but now, the parent that has the majority of custody is trying to work from home and the kids are home. And so that parent may want actually less time just so that he or she can get some work done.
We're speaking with Andrea Peterson of the Wall Street Journal. Like many other issues today, I'm sure money is part of the problem. If someone loses a job or someone is working extra, that has got to add to the tension here.
Right. Yes. I mean, I talked to some parents who, their entire income has dried up and they're very worried about, their ex-spouse's income has dried up too. So, will that child support payment come? Will they be able, for people who are paying child support, will they be able to continue to pay it? So that is adding to the stress as well. But I did talk to, one thing is, even though the courts may be closed, families can get help from marriage and family therapists, also from professional mediators. I talked to one mediator who said that he's actually seeing a real spike in calls to him from existing clients to try to help families hammer out differences about, everything from, how and when to homeschool their kids to, whether or not to take the kids onto hiking trails. Some parents have seen photos of very crowded hiking trails and are not keen on that. So there are places for parents to turn. And I talked to a couples counselor who was saying that, she's actually been quite surprised, even in couples where there has been quite a bit of conflict, that she's seen this crisis really bring people together and kind of focus on, just trying to do what's best for the kids and, try to keep everybody safe.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. It takes a while to change human behavior, but if we go a full 18 months or more with people working from home and avoiding places like malls, big box stores, and other areas where people congregate due to the coronavirus, it will force a fundamental permanent change in the way we work and interact. Rob Enderle, founder of The Enderle Group, has a look at how. Rob, how do you see this?
A lot of the behavior changes we're seeing in place. And remember, we're going to be living with this virus for the foreseeable future. There's a good chance that if we get an antivirus in 12 to 18 months, we might be able to knock it back, much like we did the measles. But, we've got the anti-vaxxer problem that we're dealing with this decade, and that kind of means we probably won't be able to knock it out like we did the measles, because the measles is back. So this is going to force a change in how we do a lot of stuff. Everything from, if you think about it, cubicles really don't make sense because they don't isolate you well enough if somebody's sick and not showing. We've already done things like we're no longer shaking hands. Even the elbow touching thing is now passe. We're just trying to waving at each other from a 6-foot distance. And if we do that long enough, that becomes ingrained in our behavior. There is a belief that that some of the old TV shows where watching people shake hands and do the other stuff might reintroduce those behaviors. But at least for now, it looks like we're going to lose a lot of behaviors that allow us to spread these diseases at least close in. And by the way, some of the beneficial side effects is we're probably going to do a lot of damage to the flu epidemic that we seem to get seasonally. So and we're seeing certainly a massive expansion of video conferencing. We're seeing a massive push rather than the companies being resistant to people working at home. They're allowing it, and it should be by the end of the 12 to 18 month period, working at home will be the norm and not the exception. And so that'll change, the size of offices we have, because a lot of people won't need to come in. We'll get much more hoteling features and capability, and certainly we'll get in more capabilities that allow for almost instant sterilization of surfaces, which are being implemented now.
Yeah. What about concerts? What happens on
events.
That front?
Yeah, I think for the foreseeable future, events are done. There's just no easy way to do it except online. You just can't have a whole lot of people in close proximity when you've got a virus like this in the environment. As I said, with the anti-vaxxer problem, it's very likely that we're going to have issues beyond 18 months. There's a rumor going around that Bill Gates engineered this thing, and that the antivirus is really poison that people are going to be using to kill you, and it's picked up an awful lot in Europe, which is going to make it really hard for us to distribute a vaccine and get people to take it after the fact. And it's just kind of sad for Bill Gates, because he was the one that first pointed out we were going to have a pandemic way back in, I think it was 2012, and then 2019 he said, okay, we're going to have a pandemic, and it's going to come from this place in China, which is where the pandemic actually originated. So he predicted it. Now people are blaming him for the virus. It's the wrong kind of irony.
All right. We're speaking with Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece for TechNewsWorld.com called COVID-19 and the End of Daily Life as We Know It. I think, too, on the education front, things could be fascinating. We're learning stuff now in terms of how to manage it. I know my own kids are still having like some glitches as they do this from home, but there's really, it's like the Wild West almost.
Well, it is, and parents are coming around to the idea of what's this really like? I mean, how do they help the kids? Everybody's home at once, so people are trying to work and go to school all in the same environment.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. First full weekend of April. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour, getting refunds for your sports tickets. Also, how closed captioning has become a hit with TV viewers. And tattoo shops helping frontline medical workers. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. It's been more than 5 weeks since the S&P 500 hit its all-time high. 5 weeks may have never felt so long. Have you done anything with your retirement savings portfolio? Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements from HumbleDollar.com is sharing what he's doing. Jonathan, take us through your strategy.
So, Gordon, over the past 5 weeks, as the market has tanked, everybody's been looking at their portfolios, and I'm certainly among them. Over the past 5 weeks, probably the biggest thing that I have been doing is rebalancing my portfolio. So everybody who invests in the market should have target percentages for how much they have in stocks, how much they have in bonds, and even within the stocks, say how much you have in the U.S. and how much you have in foreign. So for me, my mix is 30% bonds, 35% U.S. stocks, 35% foreign stocks. So over recent weeks, what I've been trying to do is to get back to those percentages.
And so at one point you said you sort of overbalanced in one direction, right? Was it stocks?
Yeah, so what happened over the past 5+ weeks is I actually came into this decline a little underweight in stocks. So instead of being at 70%, which is what my targets called for, I was at 66. And so my goal was to get up to that 70% stocks. And, of course, as I was buying more, those stocks were going down in value. So I had to not only, buy enough to get from the 66 up to 70, but I also had to buy enough to compensate for the fact that the stocks are going down in price. So I've been doing substantial buying over recent weeks. And then what happened last week was we saw quite a strong rebound. So I ended up at 70%, and then boom, because the market rebounded, it actually carried me up to 72%.
All right. So, how often could you do this? I guess as often as you want, but what's ideal?
So there are a lot of approaches towards rebalancing. Some people just do it every year. You know, some do it when their portfolio gets out of whack by a certain amount percentage. For instance, some people say that, you know, if your goal is to have 60% in stocks, you should only rebalance when you fall 20 percentage points below that. So from 60, if your stocks got down to 48%, which would be knocking off 20% there, you would rebalance at that point. I frankly am, you know, less than scientific about it. I tend to rebalance when it feels like it's the right time, when I feel like the markets have gone to extremes. So in recent years, I haven't really rebalanced very much. Over the past 5 or 6 weeks, I've been rebalancing a lot. And the nice thing about rebalancing is twofold. One, you can always do it again. So if you're too early rebalancing, you can always rebalance again. And second, if you do it, what it allows you to do is to take advantage of the market decline, even if you don't have any extra cash. So just by shifting from bonds to stocks and rebalancing during this market decline, you're taking advantage of the decline, and when the market turns around, your portfolio is going to recover a lot more quickly than somebody who isn't rebalancing.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. You said, too, you're willing to keep buying if the market goes further south.
So I'm a big believer that the market is reasonably efficient. In other words, that, you know, most of the time, stock and bond prices reflect the judgment of rational investors. When we get into a situation like we have today, where people are freaked out, the so-called noise traders, that's what academics refer to, and the people who are less than rational, come to dominate the market, and prices start to stray away from what true value would be. So if this market decline gets a whole lot worse, I would be willing to take my 70% in stocks and take it all the way up to 80%. And I've done that before. In early 2009, you know, when we had at one point the stock market down 57% from its all-time high, I went all the way up to 94 and 95% stock.
Wow. Yeah.
And I did it because it was clear that people were being irrational and that this was a great buying opportunity. And if it wasn't a great buying opportunity, if we really were going to go back to living in caves, it really wouldn't matter what I owned.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Tensions are starting to simmer between professional sports teams and some of their best customers after postponing games indefinitely because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Teams from the NBA, NHL, and Major League Baseball are effectively keeping the money of customers who bought tickets to those games instead of giving cash refunds. Here to go in-depth is Brent Scrotenbor, sports reporter at USA Today. Brent, what have you found?
Yeah, so when this big sort of asteroid hit the sports world and everybody else with the coronavirus crisis, you know, all the leagues canceling or really postponing games in the NHL, NBA, and Major League Baseball, they postponed their seasons indefinitely. Well, of course, a lot of fans, many fans, maybe $1 billion worth of tickets or more, also were sort of suspended in animation. And that means that, you know, people had bought tickets for a lot of games out there, season tickets, games that were going to happen in March, April, May, and beyond. And suddenly these seasons are in limbo. And it's like, well, what's going on with that money? What is going on with that tickets? And basically the leagues are operating under their usual postponement policy. Like, they're treating this like it's a rain out in effect. Like, if it's a baseball game normally gets rained out, then you get a credit and you can use that credit in the future. You don't get your money back in cash. All the leagues, NBA, NHL, Major League Baseball, they're holding the money of the fans that bought tickets to these games that haven't been played yet. And even though the fans want that money back, because this isn't a normal time, these aren't normal postponements, the economy is cratering. A lot of people have lost their jobs. They don't care anymore that these games might be played sometime in the future, that there might be quote-unquote makeup games. Mm-hmm. They want their money back, and so they're going to places like Ticketmaster or StubHub if they bought their tickets there, or the team's box office, and say, I want my money back. I don't care about these games anymore. Doesn't matter. This is a crisis nobody saw coming. And the teams are really, they're not giving it to them. They're operating a business as usual postponement policy because they're basically telling the fans, like, yes, you can have credit when we reschedule these games. If the games are canceled instead of being postponed, if they are officially canceled, then I think we'll see a lot of these teams and ticket sellers grant refunds, but they haven't been officially canceled yet.
We're speaking with Brent Schrotenboer, sports reporter at USA Today. His piece is called "Need a Refund on Those Tickets to NBA, NHL, or Baseball Games? Hold that thought." What happens to a place like StubHub that now has to refund a massive amount of money?
Yeah, exactly. And as one of the people in the story explained to me the other day, StubHub is probably very much rooting for a postponement and a rescheduling of these games and hoping that these games are replayed because they are a ticket reseller. And so their policy is they are not giving a refund unless these games are canceled. And if these games are canceled, then StubHub would basically lose all of its money. It would refund the principal ticket amount, and then it would refund the fees that it collected as well. And that's how StubHub makes money, is it tax on fees to these transactions. And their policy is to return the fees and the ticket amount in the event of a cancellation. And because the games haven't been canceled yet and are only postponed, quote unquote, they are in the state of limbo too. And they're hoping that they are actually postponed and rescheduled so they can hang on to that money.
All right. Thanks, Brent. Brent Schrotenboer, sports reporter at USA Today. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
You're a small business owner, and there's nothing small about what you do. That's why Dell Small Business Technology Advisors give you trusted advice, one-on-one partnership, and tailored tech solutions, like computers with Intel Core processors, servers, storage, networking, plus thousands of top-brand electronics, accessories, and software. No matter your technology needs, Dell is here to help your small business do big things. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for being with us. Subtitles have always been required reading for people watching foreign language films, and for deaf and hard of hearing audiences, captioning is vital to any screen experience involving sound. But some of the people most committed to captioning don't need it at all. They're viewers who hear just fine, but prefer to read along with everything they watch, including TV shows and movies, in their own language. John Jurgensen, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, has a look at this subculture of subtext, as he calls it. John, what's this about?
So a lot of people are familiar with closed captioning because they see it on the bottom of the screen when they're at the gym working out or they're at the bar watching a game, the transcription of what's being said on the screen. Of course, that's there for deaf or hard of hearing audiences, and it's been there for a long time. But I am writing about the kind of lifestyle choice that a lot of people are choosing to use closed captions just as a way to enhance their viewing experience. These are people who don't need it, who hear just fine, but really sort of prefer to have that kind of text crawl across their screen because it just kind of enhances the viewing experience for them and the understanding of what's happening on screen.
You know, it's funny you wrote about this because my daughter was watching TV the other day. I think she was watching a Netflix program, and she had the subtitles, the closed captioning. I said, why don't you turn that off? Isn't that distracting? She's like, no, it helps me understand like what some people are saying, like if they're mumbling or, you know, have an accent or something like that. I thought that
is so weird. And how old is your daughter?
So she's 15. She's a high school sophomore. I thought, so my question to you is this a young people thing?
I believe it is. The story is not really about this, but it kind of became about this for me in reporting it because it really does seem like it's become a generational change. And you would think it would be mostly older audiences who have possibly some hearing loss that are relying on this stuff. But what I'm finding, and I found in the story, almost everyone I interviewed for the story were, you know, in their 20s or, you know, teens even. And I found that it's really become a shift in the way that young people are doing this. I think they're picking it up from each other, but there's also just this complete format change for the way we interact with stuff, interact with media, especially on the internet. So think about being online where we're on social media, we see these memes pop up and there's always a little caption photo. We're watching clips online. A lot of those clips are captioned because they know people are watching with the sound off as they scroll through their Twitter feed or their Instagram feed or what have you. So captioned images have just become part of the landscape. And for especially young viewers, just a part of the way they interpret the world. Also, a lot of young viewers I talk to say that it just helps with their attention issues. You know, they may not be diagnosed with ADHD or something like that, but they feel that they're just kind of always processing lots of different things at the same time, whether they're scanning their phone while they're watching TV or just wanting to get a better grasp of what they're viewing. So it's become kind of standard among young people as far as I've found.
How about that? John Jurgensen, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Personal piercings and permanent ink aren't the only things coronavirus heroes and tattoo shops have in common these days. Fox News says with many body art businesses closed due to social distancing and prevention guidelines, tattoo artists across the country have become an ally for healthcare workers and first responders who are seeking necessities. Carrie Henning, owner of Cloud 9 Tattoo and Body Piercing in Birmingham, Alabama, is around the corner from UAB University Hospital. She donated the isolation gowns that she typically uses for sterilizing her body art equipment. Police in Whiteland, Indiana, used Facebook to thank a shop called Angels and Demons Tattoo for dropping off a case of gloves for cops. Mel Newman, shop manager for the Mighty Horseman Tattoo Company in Westchester County, New York, got a voicemail from a local paramedic in desperate need for supplies. She donated hundreds of pairs of gloves from her shop as quickly as she could. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.